interview with Dennis Alexander. Dennis, why don't you tell me just briefly a little bit about yourself, your background and your current interests?
Yes, I'm a retired molecular immunologist. I spent 40 years in the research community. Actually, I started life as a neurochemist, did a PhD in the Institute of Psychiatry in London. But in later life, I moved more into human genetics. And then for the past 20 years before I closed down my lab, I was actually working in the area of molecular immunology and cancer research. So I've had 40 years in the research community and covered quite a few different disciplines along the way. And then when I closed down my lab in 2008, that period of time, in fact, in 2006, I set up something called the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion, which to the present day is part of St. Edmund's College, Cambridge, one of Cambridge's 31 colleges. And I set it up together with my colleague, Professor Bob White, who's the Professor of Geophysics in Cambridge. And so that's what I've been doing in my little retirement job. And I was director until 2012 and then handed over to Professor White, who is now the director of that institute. So I've got more engaged in the whole area of science and religion and ethics, those sort of things, in my retirement.
Now let's go back to genetics. A lot has happened in the last 14, 15 years in genetics, hasn't it, since the sequencing of the human genome. Tell us what the significance of that is.
That's right. I mean, genetics has been advancing at a great rate, and as with many sciences, it's marked by certain what we might call phase transitions, where new technology comes along or new discoveries, new advances, which actually take the whole field into new arenas or with new applications. And the most recent one of those is a new genetic engineering technique called CRISPR-Cas, which was really invented over the period 2012 to 2015. That's when a whole slew of papers came out with concerning this technique, which basically, like the rest of molecular biology, is utilizing materials and systems which are already out there in the living world, but applying them in different contexts. So CRISPR-Cas is a molecular complex that's found in bacteria, which they use for their own immune system to defend themselves against attack by viruses and that kind of thing. And the way it's now used in genetic engineering is a little bit like taking a pair of genetic scissors inside the cell. And the difference between this complex and the other ones that have been used is that it's possible to make a excision to cut the DNA in any cell at a very precise point. So part of the complex is what's called an RNA guide molecule. This is like a guide takes the complex to exactly the right place in the DNA, and then the Cas bit is a pair of scissors, and that goes cut, and it cuts the DNA exactly where you want it, and it can just take out a genetic letter, a nucleotide base, out of the DNA, and then the cell's own machinery will then put the correct, if you like, quote-unquote, nucleotide base or DNA letter right back into the DNA. So it's a very powerful bit of machinery, molecular machinery, that can be used to change any DNA of any organism in the world, including the human.
Now, the DNA is the sort of code that controls our physical development, isn't it? Does this mean that we can cut out diseases?
Potentially. There have been a number of papers out now doing what they call embryo editing, so taking a very early human embryo, and they've been utilizing embryos that carry a particular genetic defect for a particular disease, such as thalassemia, for example. In fact, the first paper that came out on this was from a Chinese group in 2015, and they were generating early embryos, human embryos, in vitro fertilization clinics that carry the genetic defect that causes thalassemia. And it's now, their success rate using CRISPR-Cas to correct that mutation was pretty low. But in the years since then, over the past few years, there have been a number of other studies coming out where the success rate has been going up quite a bit. And so in principle, it's possible to do that. In practice, it's possible to do it. It's still a research technique. It's illegal to then implant the corrected embryos. or the edited embryos back into a mother. That's still illegal in pretty much all the countries of the world where this kind of work's going on. But I guess that's the end goal. That's where the research groups are. That's what they're thinking about for the future.
So you said that human embryos with thalassemia were being developed. That means we're deliberately producing human embryos to experiment on.
Yep, it would certainly involve that. So, for example, if you take one research group last year in the States, published a paper about a particular gene that causes thickening of the heart muscle when it's mutated, and this is a common cause of sudden death in young athletes. And they took a whole, they managed to find somebody who had that particular genetic defect, and they used his sperm to fertilize, I think about, it was a whole range of eggs in vitro. And so this is a case of deliberately generating very early embryos which will have the defect, and then to experiment with them, essentially using CRISPR-Cas to seek to heal those embryos, to remove the genetic defect which came from that one individual in this case.
Let's move on to other ethical, perhaps concerning issues. If we're able to edit the human genome, does this mean that changes will be passed on to my children, for example? And what if we get things wrong? And if we get things right, does this mean that we will be able to simply make human beings in whatever image we want to make them, and just keep on making them, quote, better?
Well, at the moment, the way the technology is going is that there is a risk of what they call off-target mutations. So let's say you're targeting one genetic letter out of 3.2 billion. That's the total number of genetic letters in the human genome, in the human DNA. I mean, that's unbelievable precision. And until very recently, the problem was that there were pretty much always off-site targets. That is to say that changes were taking place also at sites where they didn't want them to take place. As it happens, just last week a paper came out, I noticed, which claims to now have a new technique to prevent that and to make it much easier to quickly detect any off-target mutations and so on. So I think it's pretty clear the way the technology is going that pretty soon it's going to be pretty tight. In other words, there will be checks and balances in place in such a way that it will be possible to be pretty sure that only one single change has taken place. So if that's the case, then potentially, yes, one could heal human embryos from a genetic disease in vitro in the laboratory in a way that then that correction will be passed on not only to that individual if they're then placed in the mother to be born, but also obviously to their generations to come. If they get married and have kids, they would also have no problem from that particular disease, whatever it might be. So it is a real healing, a potential healing of that whole family history from that particular disease.
So that's healing. You're using the word healing, but when does healing become, you know, I mean, what happens if somebody wants a taller child or a faster child or a blonder child? Normally we wouldn't think of those things as healing, but presumably we could also reprogram the genetics in order to bring that about.
Well, it turns out, due to a huge amount of work in the area of behavioral genetics and also medical genetics over the past 20, 30 years, that if we take something quite complex, height actually turns out to be very complex, and if we take something even more complex like intelligence or educational attainment or sporting prowess, and these are very complex traits that we have as humans that vary between us, of course, in any given population. It turns out that, let's take educational attainment, there are hundreds and probably thousands actually of genetic variants that contribute to the variation in population with regard to educational attainment. And so, in a sense, the human genome is its own best protector against meddlers because it's just so complicated. And so I think it's a little bit naive to think that we can mess around with the human genome and create, you know, super intelligent people, because what we're really talking about here is virtually a different kind of genome from the one we've got, or certainly a genome that's different from what you'd find in a huge population range in around the world. So in theory, you know, on paper, it looks like you could do it. But in practice, we're talking here about thousands of genetic variants. And there's no guarantee, even if you changed all of those in one individual, that that individual would become super intelligent, actually, because these variants are identified in huge populations of people. A recent study came out looking at 1.2 million Europeans, people of European descent, and they worked out there's around 1,100 genetic variants they've identified so far that contribute to the variation in educational attainment in that population. So, in other words, it's a little bit unrealistic to think we can suddenly create, as I say, individuals with super intelligence.
I don't know a lot about the transhumanism movement, but I know that that's perhaps the sorts of aspirations that they are after, isn't it? Isn't that right?
That's right. I think the, of course, transhumanists, what they want to do, as the name suggests, is to is to create humans beyond the human. And they have a very low view of our current biology. They just think, you know, where we've got to so far is pretty pathetic. You know, humans are feeble and we should use all that we can in the way of technology to try and enhance human capabilities. And they have the future hope that one day we will create machines that will actually think for themselves, and then we'll be so intelligent that it'll be possible to download our own human minds into digital space or formats, and then we will become, and we will live forever, you know, with this sort of digital minds, that sort of thing. I mean, that's a sort of rather wacky kind of eschatology. They have this future hope and so forth. So, yeah, so they're very gung-ho with all these kind of technologies. And I think also the trouble is that sometimes their technology is a bit divorced from reality. And, of course, biology is a case in point where they do think, I think many of them, that you could potentially genetically engineer the human genome to create super intelligent people, that sort of thing. I just don't think they've quite got their heads around the complexity of the human genome and of biology in generally, and how genes interact with the environment during the process of human development as well. So I think there's quite a bit of naivety there, and I think it's partly because many of them are computer geeks, to be frank, and they are people who are, you know, much more used to working with machines and with artificial intelligence, and much less used to working with biology.
The other night, I think you made some comments about the parallels between transhumanism as a sort of movement and Christian faith.
Yes, that's right. I think, in a sense, transhumanism is a highly secularized form of Christian doctrine or the Christian worldview, in the sense, and I'll illustrate that by what I mean. So they believe in a sort of parallel of sin. Sin for the transhumanist is living in a biological body with all its failings, and we should be really unhappy about that. We should want to get out of our bodies into something much better. Okay, so that's sin. And then they believe, so alienation for them is the sense of being alienated from what we could be if we really tried hard enough and made wonderful, wonderful machines and transformed humans into something technically quite different. So salvation clearly for them lies in machinery and in robots and in artificial intelligence and all that technoscience can bestow upon us. So it's a techno-scientific salvation. And then they also have this eschatology where they're looking forward to immortality, but the immortality is expressed not in a resurrected body, as in the case of Christian faith, but in a very platonic sort of digital mind future without any body in sight. So some people have said it's pies in the skies when we digitize, that kind of idea.
So given all those parallels, but they don't have a god, do they? I guess their god is the superhuman, the scientist even?
Yes, I mean, everybody has a god, with a small g maybe, and the transhumanist generally worships technology, I would say. That's their god. And beyond that, they worship themselves, because their goal really is the transformation of me. And it's strikingly non-relational in this this whole project is much more to do with my transformation technically, my enhancement, and my future in digital space, doesn't seem to be very much room for human relations or what bodies can do for you. And I, you know, some people notice that some of their aspirations are very like those of, you know, computer geeks in Silicon Valley, to be frank. I mean, they almost be making people, their future hope for people is made in their own image in that sense. So everybody, when they create something, make it in their own image. And of course, when they make it in their own image, it has all the shortcomings and failings of we humanity.
Moving, excuse me, moving on from that, or perhaps reflecting on that, you travel a lot and you speak a lot and you mix with people talking about these cultural issues. What do you see as the place of Christian faith in at least Western countries like Australia? We've had the New Atheism movement, which was strong a number of years ago, seems to be fading. What's going on in Western culture with respect to Christian faith?
Well, as you know, Western culture is very fragmented at the moment, and in particular in the USA is highly polarized, partly for political reasons. And of course, politics gets mixed up with religion, and that doesn't help sensible, coherent discourse, unfortunately. But I think what the need is that I see, and which is happening to some degree, I think, in the churches in the Western world, is to not only generate but propagate a Christian vision that encompasses the whole of life, and that shows how the Christian alternative to things like humanism and transhumanism and all those sort of ideologies is a far richer and more encompassing worldview than they can provide. And I think in that sense, transhumanism is a particularly interesting conversation partner, because you know, when you read their books, it's so obvious where it seems obvious perhaps to the Christian more, but it's so obvious where the deficits are, where this lack of compassion, relational well-being, you know, human flourishing. Human flourishing just doesn't seem to happen really through technology. You get more and more people, more and more technology, it doesn't seem to make them much happier. Once you get them out of poverty and out of, you know, the grind of being in some terrible low-paid job somewhere, once you get them out of that, well, you know, just more and more technology from historical data doesn't seem to make people more happier. And I think Christians can come in with a message here that human flourishing and all that we think about when we think about how to human well-being, how to flourish as a human being in the world, is much more likely to come as people find their ultimate goal in God, who is the one who is got the plan for the whole of the universe, and it gives a much more all-encompassing worldview, I would say, than some of these worldviews that are very restricted to technical answers. So I think this is a great opportunity we have here as Christians, actually, to engage with these other worldviews and so on. I think the danger is that has happened to some degree in the Western Church in the past half a century, really, but is the because of the increasing secularization of Western societies, the Church has had a tendency to go into its spiritual castle and put up the drawbridge and throw the occasional rock out, spiritual rock, you know, and so forth, and hasn't always engaged as it could have done in the public space which is available to really engage other ideologies and to put forward its perspective robustly and carefully in the public domain. And I think there's a great need for the Church to do that. As a matter of fact, I was just last week in Sydney with the public center, the Center for Public Christianity, and I thought that's exactly what Christians should be doing, is to communicating through radio and podcasts and magazines and so forth a vision of the world which is within the Christian worldview. It's not preaching at people, it's simply mapping out, look, this is what a Christian worldview looks like, this is an impact on science, technology, the arts, humanities, right across the board. And I just think that's where we should be heading.
You've been very involved in Christians in Science in the UK and the Faraday Centre, obviously. What is the place for organisations like that? Here in Australia, ISCAST, also known as Christians in Science, in this cultural discussion?
I think they can play a very important role, because they, in terms of Christians in Science and ISCAST and so forth, they can gather together Christians out there in the scientific community, not only to discuss their own relationship between science and faith and their own particular disciplines. That's really important. But I think also to make the point to the wider secular culture that it's very normal to be a Christian in the scientific community. And I think that's a point often missed by scientists. They don't often know the history of science. They don't know that modern science was basically started by Christians, more or less, that's the case. And so the Christians can sort of huddle a little bit together without making it clear, you know, that their Christian faith is really relevant to their science in many different ways. So I think that's a very important role that Christians and scientists and so on can have, and indeed that is what we're seeking to do. Likewise in the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion in Cambridge.
At the Faraday Institute, what were your, what are your, those things that pleased you most, those things that you were most happy that you were able to do?
I think the things we've been most happy with is to engage with the scientific community. That's always been top of our list, really, in ways that they find interesting and attractive, that brings a lot of scientists along to activities and so forth. And so sometimes that's been through quite large public events, and other times it's just been through workshops or through conferences and so on. We had a workshop a few years ago to mark an anniversary in the life of Georges Lemaître, the Belgian priest who was the first one really to describe what we now call the Big Bang. He called it the primeval atom. Famous paper he brought out in 1931. Well, let's put it, the translation into English from French was in 1931, and it was translated as the primeval atom, what later on came to be called the Big Bang. And there's no doubt that he was the originator of the idea of the Big Bang as a mathematician. Well, we had a conference to celebrate the 1931 paper, and you know, a lot of people came along to that, and it made quite an impact more broadly within the field of mathematical physics and so forth. And so those sort of things we're very happy about. Some years ago we sponsored a play. This was to help celebrate the 800th anniversary of the founding of the University of Cambridge, and we wanted to contribute something that was relevant to science, religion, and also relevant to the history of Cambridge. So we sponsored a new play on Isaac Newton, which Craig, the playwright, called Let Newton Be, and that was put on in first time in 2009. So we had the premiere performance in Trinity College, which is Newton's old college, and we had Stephen Hawking, kind of the late Stephen Hawking, kind of came along to give a welcome to the play, and Lord Martin Rees, who was the master of the college at the time, came along to give it a welcome, and so forth. So, and that was open to all the fellows of the college and people who wanted to come along and so forth. So that kind of thing, I think, placing an artistic creation, I think, in right in the middle of the scientific community or in the middle of Cambridge in one of its best-known colleges. I mean, that sort of thing, you know, we like doing that. You know, we don't want to be a huddle away. That's huddling away. We're just sort of people around the table talking to themselves, really. We want to talk to the wider community through the arts, through science and so forth, to get the message across that science, religion is a very positive discussion, and there's always been this wonderful positive relationship between these two domains of activity. Another thing that we were very happy about in the Faraday Institute is that although we don't do public debates, we do from time to time do public discussions, which have a different flavour, where we allow people with different views to stand up and express their different views in a public domain. And one that we had back again, I think it was 2009, we decided, and this was a time when the new atheism was still quite prominent in the media and so forth, in a way that it's certainly not now. But we decided we'd get the Archbishop of Canterbury, Professor Rowan Williams, in discussion with Professor Terry Eagleton, who's a well-known English literature professor and literary critic, and who is, we actually thought, was an atheist, I have to say. That's why I invited him. And we gave them the topic of responses to the new atheism. So Rowan Williams did the religious response to the new atheism, and Professor Eagleton did the political response to the new atheism. And we had it in Great St. Mary's. This is the university church in Cambridge, and it was packed. It takes 1,400 people, if you have a lot of people sitting on the in the aisles and so forth, you have 1,400 people. I think we broke the, well, I shouldn't say this on it, we probably broke the fire regulations, but and it was absolutely packed, and we had a huge number of atheists came along and so forth. But anyway, the funny, I was chairing this meeting, and then Professor Eagleton stood up to give his 10 minutes presentation. He's very funny, actually. He's very critical of Richard Dawkins. It's extremely funny. In fact, he's written a whole book critiquing the sort of new atheism as an atheist from an atheist perspective. The funny thing was, he talked more about Jesus, you know, than the Archbishop. I mean, he went on Jesus the Revolutionary, and he's kind of a 1960s tub-thumping socialist, basically. But anyway, and then Rowan Williams spoke, and they had a bit of discussion. We had some open questions. But it turned out, we didn't know this, actually, that Professor Eagleton had rather returned to his Catholic roots, in fact, and I think, and was no longer the stringent atheist that we had imagined him to be. So we got a bit of flack, you know, a bit of criticism for the atheists, because they thought we'd set this up as a sort of deliberate thing. We really hadn't. We were, you know, in good faith, we had invited him. We thought he was a proper atheist, you know. So anyway, but I mean, those are sort of things we're quite happy about, because they just bring a lot more people into the discussion, and they help different people to come along and get engaged.
We're driving through the streets of Melbourne at the moment. There are hundreds, thousands of people around us. This is where the rubber meets the road. Maybe the majority of these people would think there was a fundamental conflict between robust, serious science and robust, serious Christianity. How do we deal with that at the popular level?
Yeah, it's a funny... Well, first of all, it's a sort of strange thing, really, isn't it? Even that is part of our culture. And, of course, there's quite a lot of interest as to where these ideas come from. And most historians, I think, would see the so-called conflict idea between science and religion as really emerging during the latter decades of the 19th century with the growing professionalization of science. And I think the idea there is that as science began to become a separate profession from the rest of the academic disciplines, so somehow, you know, scientists, as they came to be called at that time, went off and they went their own particular way, the theologians went their way, and they lost the art of talking to each other. And then during the 20th century, that was rather reinforced by various things that happened. But it's a fairly recent phenomenon in the history of science and religion, I think, to see them as two separate domains. And most people would see them only as separating out, really, in the 19th century and becoming two different disciplines and ideas. So how do we change that? I think there are many different ways. I think one really important way is simply when the scientific community is aware that there are really top scientists, as there are, who are committed Christians, then that in itself, I think, has a very powerful influence. And I can give you an illustration of that. When Professor Elaine Eklund, who's Professor of Sociology at Rice University, when her team were doing a huge, great study of the religious beliefs of scientists in the USA and comparing them with the religious beliefs of scientists in many other countries of the world, what they found, particularly in the United States, was, although they weren't asking questions about this particularly, but during during the interview, the sort of questionnaire time they had with individual scientists who were selected at random, quite a number said, well, I know it's possible. I'm not a religious person myself, but I know it's possible to be a Christian because Francis Collins is a Christian. And they all know that this director of the National Institutes of Health, which is the top science job in the USA, I was going to say the world, probably in the world too, but is a committed Christian, and he's been quite public about his faith. And that fact alone, I think, has done a lot to help, you know, many, many scientists to say, well, you know, I'm not religious, but I know you can be, and you can be a good scientist because, hey, look at Francis Collins. So I think there are a number of others, of course. I'm just speaking on him because I know that was cited by Len Eklund. But I think there are a number of other examples that, you know, that where that's the case. And as a matter of fact, I think we in the Faraday Institute played a small role, at least, in giving Christians who are quite well known in the scientific community a public platform in which to share their ideas about what it means to be a Christian in the scientific community. And I think that itself actually has had probably some influence in people's thinking.
Well, Dennis, thank you very much for talking to me. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your time here in Australia.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.